Now, given that the TGRC is an ongoing project, it's too early to kind of say, you know, what are the truths that are revealed, shaped, obscured, etc., or to draw conclusions about its achievements and legacies. And actually, when I said I would do this seminar, it was before the TGRC had been given an extension, and they were supposed to submit their report on the 3rd of November this year. So I've kind of slightly changed my topic in lieu of the fact that the commission is still ongoing. So what I want to do in this paper is to introduce the commission, outline its performative or theatrical character, and analyse what the process reveals about ethnic politics and ethnic identities. And I've chosen to focus on ethnic identities because it's kind of long-term interest of mine, but also because it's central to how the TGRC has been conducting its work and how people have been appearing before the Commission, just as race and national politics was central to the work of the South African TRC. But I think also because ethnicity provides a good example of the kind of insights that can be gained by a kind of close analysis of something like a truth commission. But I should stress at the beginning that ethnicity is not the only significant identity that it kind of emerges or is shaped by the commission's work. And I could have focused on other things. I could have, for example, looked at nationalism, religion, gender, class, or I could have focused in on what it says about civil society within Kenya or the role of the international community, and so on and so forth. And I'm happy to talk about some of those issues in the Q&A if people are interested. So just to summarise, I'll argue that the Commission's performative processes provide a window onto contemporary Kenyan politics and show and on the kind of nature, salience and violent potential of ethnic identities. And I'll use this as an example. More specifically, I argue that the TGRC helps to highlight issues and problems, how issues and problems are often interpreted and cast through an ethnic lens that is coloured by the negotiability of ethnic identities, the words and actions of political elites, and competition over scarce resources and economic inequalities, but how also elite action and local grievances are interconnected through communal narratives of a politics of belonging and a politics of a special or particular suffering. So the Commission started its two-year mandate in November 2009, and it was awarded a six-month extension in August of this year. And the Commission was established following Kenya's post-election violence of late 2007, early 2008, where over 1,000 people died and almost 700,000 people were displaced. However, its mandate is much bigger, and it runs from the country's independence in December 1963 right up to the signing of a national accord on the 28th of February 2008, so that's just over 44 years. It can also take account of relevant antecedents and precedents, and it has adopted a flexible approach to its end date. And this extended timeframe recognises that while the post-election crisis was triggered by claims that the election had been stolen, it was about much more deep-seated problems and grievances. And for this same reason, the TGRC departs from a common focus of truth commissions on political repression and seeks to establish, and here I quote, an accurate, complete, an accurate, complete and historical record of violations and abuses of human rights and economic rights inflicted on persons by the state, public institutions, and holders of public office. And the abuses to be investigated include massacres, acts of state repression, misuse of public institutions for political objectives, irregular land acquisition, sexual violations, perceptions of economic marginalisation, causes of political violence and ethnic tension, and the list goes on for several pages. So the TGRC is saddled with, you know, the largest temporal anti-matic mandate of any truth commission to date. And this is problematic, but it also makes the commission a fascinating thing to study, because if people can bring any basically kind of injustice before it, You know, what do people choose as the relevant stories and how do they choose to frame them? Unfortunately, the Commission's first year was absorbed by Wrangel's over the chairman, Bethwell Kiplagat, who was a permanent secretary in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs when the then foreign minister was assassinated. He's also named into a presidential commission into irregular land acquisition as somebody who was a beneficiary of irregular land allocations under President Moy. And he was also at a meeting in February 1984 when it's alleged a decision was made to round up all the men from a particular Somalian clan in a part of northern Kenya and to bring them to an airstrip in one of the hottest parts of the country at one of the hottest times of the year, to strip them, beat them, not give them any water or food, and after several days, the kind of commotion broke out. People understandably tried to escape, and the police and military opened fire, and it said that either between 30 or thousands of people died. So given this background, it's understandable that critics argued that Kiplagat should be summoned before the commission rather than chair the process. And people said that his appointment was actually a Machiavellian attempt to undermine the commission from the outset. And this kind of Kiplagat issue was unfortunate as it prompted many civil society and organisations and donors to walk away. It also allowed the government to step back from a process that had initially been pushed forward by civil society activists and foreign mediators. It also damaged the commission's public credibility. And it ultimately meant that the commission did virtually nothing during its first year in office until Kiplagat stepped aside, albeit on full pay, in November 2010. But despite this problematic start and associated issues of limited human resources, civic education, and media coverage, progress has been made. But public opinion remains mixed. So, for example, the commission has been able to collect more statements than any other truth commission to date, around 40,000. But there's also a very pervasive sense in Kenya of commission fatigue. An idea that this commission is going to be like the long string of commissions that have gone before it, where it will write a good report, but the recommendations will not be acted upon. For reasons of time, I don't want to go into too much detail about the commission, about how the commission has been doing its work. But there are a couple of things that are worth highlighting, especially as most people within Kenya, let alone outside of Kenya, don't really know very much about the commission. So first of all, statement takers were hired across the country to collect statements and memorandum. TGRC investigators then went through the statements and memorandum and selected people as potential witnesses, went and talked to them, and then passed files over to the legal team who selected final witnesses for the hearings. And hearings have been held across the country. The usual setup is for there to be a platform at the front of the hall, usually up on a small platform, where the commissioners sit. There's then a witness table down on the floor, where there's the witness, the leader of evidence, hearing clerk, and usually a counsellor. And next to this table, usually in the middle of the room, there's one of the councillors, is a table with the transcription equipment, so the people from Hansard, and also it's where any international observers or kind of visiting dignitaries sit, and their people are provided with headphones where they can listen to the proceedings in English or Kiswahili. And then down the other side of the room, you have the translators, who translate into English for the international commissioners and visitors, into Kiswahili for the general audience. And finally, behind the witness and observer tables sit the general public. There's usually more men than women who attend, relatively few youth attend, and public attendance is varied, but it tends to drop off during hearings in any one particular locality. And it can sometimes consist of only a handful of people. So here there's quite a good turnout in Kericho and Rift Valley. But here, if you know who the people are in this photograph, there's really only three people who are not members of TGRC staff. Women's forums are also held in each locality, and these are much less formal, but they're also more compelling and emotionally draining than their public counterparts, and I'd be happy to discuss what kind of goes on in the women's hearings in more detail in the Q&A. There's also in-camera hearings for people who don't want to speak in public, and also hearings for adversely mentioned people, where the witnesses are kind of cross-examined in a way that they're not in the public hearings. So, for example, when Kiplagat appeared before the commission in June of this year to talk about what he knew of the Wagala massacre, he was kind of on the witness stand, if you like, for about 7 hours. Hearings have gone ahead relatively smoothly, but given the other problems that the commission has faced, it's almost inevitable that they've been imperfect in various ways. So problems include, for example, the fact that now the TGRC is having to hold public, women's, in-camera and adversely mentioned people's hearings in 2 days in each locality, which really isn't enough time. There's often seen investigations and research prior to the hearings, relatively poor communications, last-minute changes, and a low level of public engagement and media coverage. So, unlike, for example, the South African TRC, which was kind of constantly in the news, the TGRC very rarely makes it onto the evening news, and you can have hearings in a particular location, but there's not a single article in any of the major newspapers about the hearings in a particular place. One thing that has been striking about the hearings, and which is common to truth commissions in other contexts, has been their kind of theatrical nature. So there is a kind of, to a certain extent, a script, there is a certain amount of stage management, there are also lead characters, interlocutors, and audiences. And personal attendance provides a very different experience to reading about the hearings in the newspapers or hearing about them through word of mouth. I think interesting in and of itself, the idea of performance also points to a central disagreement regarding the role of truth commissions. So does their value actually lie in the performative dimension and the space that they give for kind of a pouring out of emotion and feeling? Or do performances help to disseminate and normalise dominant or emergent narratives and help create new frameworks of knowledge? Alternatively, does the value of truth commissions stem from the reforms that they ultimately recommend and help prompt or support? My feeling is that truth commissions are valued by a lot of different groups of people because they can potentially do all of these things. So there can be some immediate cathartic benefits. However, this is limited to those who get a chance to speak or to those who feel that their story has been heard or told by others. And it will likely be only temporary if no one really listens or acts. So here, I think a comment by one gentleman following a hearing in Isiolo in Upper Eastern was kind of indicative. He said, he did feel better for speaking before the commission, but he likened it to vomiting when one is feeling sick. By throwing up, it can bring some immediate relief, but if you don't cure the sickness, you might feel the need to throw up in the near future. And I think this highlights the importance of what happens to the truths revealed, and this is something that I'll come back to later. But it's worth noting that the success or failure of the TGRC is to a certain extent now dependent on the final report and implementation of or lobbying around the same. And this is particularly true of the TGRC since the impact of truths revealed is central to the TGRC's work and its explicit inclusion of justice. And this signals a kind of attempt at a further evolution of truth commissions, if you like, from the exposure of abuses and acknowledgement of denied realities associated with early truth commissions to the idea that what was important was a verbalisation of painful memories as part of a process of individual and collective healing, characteristic of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions of the 1990s and 2000s, to the idea, which is explicit in the TGRC Act, that truths can also highlight what is required for justice to be done, and therefore for reconciliation to be possible in the future. And the TGRC is able to recommend reparations, selective amnesty, further investigations, prosecutions, and institutional reforms. Alternatively, however, some see truth commissions as having little value in terms of transitional justice, but as nevertheless valued political tools. A truth commission, like other commissions of inquiry, providing, as Adam Ashforth has argued, a theatre of power in which to construct frameworks of knowledge that can help legitimise particular nationalist narratives and political regimes, as Richard Wilson has argued for South Africa, or which can simply provide a distraction to more meaningful reforms, as Duncan McCargo has argued of the Truth Commission in Thailand. I think this idea of a Truth Commission as a theatre or theatricalisation of power and as a potentially a distraction, which can provide some catharsis, recommend reforms, but also help legitimate and disseminate new narratives and provide a stage for debates and power relations to be played out, it's important as it reminds us that truth commissions do not so much reveal as shape and socially construct the truth. And they do this in ways that aren't neutral, but which reflect a complex interplay between actors and audiences, institutions, discourses, narratives, and structures. And as a result, I think they provide an interesting window onto the nature and interpretations of power and group relations and struggles over the same. So if we're to understand something like the TGRC in this way, what can it reveal about ethnic identities, ethnic politics, and ethnic conflict in contemporary Kenya? First of all, ethnic identities emerge as an important part of how Kenyans regard themselves and how they're viewed by others. So there's clearly an idea that different ethnic groups need to be represented at the hearings for the TGRC to be legitimate and successful. And as a result, the commission staff explicitly seek to pick window cases that will represent different ethnic groups within any one locality, and it's also reflected in the way they manage the kind of open mic parts of the women's forums. This is also reflected, however, in the way that monitors and members of the public are very quick to criticise the TGRC if any communities appear to be left out in any particular area. It's also true that many of the witnesses choose to display their ethnic identity and their position in ethnic hierarchies by wearing traditional attire. There's the commissioner standing up for the national anthem. So here you have a warrior giving evidence in Baringo. Here you have a Talai elder who's wearing a kind of traditional monkey skin cloak. And here you have an Okiek elder who's been given a laurel wreath. And he was given this kind of during the testimony. So after he'd given most of his testimony, the people who had accompanied him were invited to come up to kind of stand up, and they got up but also came to the front and sang a song and danced, and then on their kind of retreat back to their chairs gave this gentleman this wreath. Presentations and discussions also suggest a clear tendency for people to read problems and solutions through an ethnic lens, at least in this kind of context. So many memoranda and statements included implicit or explicit reference to the idea that an individual group or area has suffered because of their ethnic identity, and that they suffered at the hands of ethnic others or an ethnically biased state. And this kind of ethnic lens is also evident in responses to the whole kind of Kiplagat issue, and the fact that members of Kiplagat's own ethnic group, the Kalenjin, came out strongly in his defence. So a number of prominent Kalenjin argued that the TGRC offered a chance for them to highlight the historical injustices that they faced, particularly those relating to lost lands, and to counter a common view of Callaghan as perpetrators of election-related violence. In turn, they argued that people had called for Kiplagat's removal because he was Callaghan and because he would therefore take the land issue seriously. And the idea was that other communities didn't want the land issue to be taken seriously, and they also wanted to kind of demonise all Callaghan as perpetrators and did not want to see them in public life. And these are the last two comments are quotes from the chairman of the Callaghan Council of Elders and a Callaghan bishop, so you know, fairly prominent people. Second, by recognising ethnic difference, the Commission helps, albeit in a marginal way, to reinforce a sense of the same and could potentially feed into the reproduction of ethnic inequalities. So, for example, by selecting window cases from different ethnic groups and by lining up elders and other representatives to present ethnic memorandum, the TJRC provides a forum for the articulation and legitimation of ethnic narratives. Moreover, due to local differences in organisation and research capacity and a limited understanding of the Commission's mandate, some groups have been better able to research and present their story in a way that fits the Commission's idea of good testimony, with preference clearly given to a coherent story that can also provide supplementary supportive evidence, be it colonial archival documents, be it government or non-government reports, statistics, photographs, and so forth. And I think the way in which a recognition of difference can unintentionally lead to a reproduction of inequality, although I don't want to kind of overdo this point, is also evident from the women's forums, where the fact that women and children are seen to have suffered more than men has led to an approach that tends to cast women as victims rather than agents and men as perpetrators in a way that could reinforce gendered stereotypes. However, in addition to revealing the assumed significance of ethnic identities while doing little, at least in the short term, to counter an associated sense of difference, the TGRC also highlights how ethnic identities are not the only, or even in many occasions, the most important identity, and how they interact with and are often reinforced by other identities such as nation, gender, generation, class, and religion. I just want to give one example here of kind of connection, if you like, between religion and spirituality and ethnicity. So religion is central to the work of the TGRC. I mean, the hearings, for example, begin and end with a prayer, be it Islamic or Christian prayer, depending on the location. And a number of sessions have been held in churches or church halls. More striking is the language of some of the commissioners, most notably Judge Gertrude Chawatama, who's here singing a Zambian gospel song at a women's hearings in Kericho, and whose contributions at the hearings are often kind of loaded with biblical references. More interesting, however, is how religion and spirituality emerge as central to understandings of ethnic, national, and racial identities as members of a tribe as Kenyans and Africans, and also to how early discussions suggest that the report will likely include recommendations for traditional reconciliation mechanisms that are imbued with an understanding of Africans as communal and spiritual beings. So as a result, commissioners often ask witnesses, once people have given their testimony, there's a kind of time in which commissioners can ask questions, and the commissioners often specifically ask witnesses about local traditions, for example, about memorialising death, cleansing wrongdoers, and reconciling warring communities. And this is kind of understandable and may have positive contributions, but it also shows how there's a kind of interweaving, if you like, of a kind of religious or spiritual and ethnic identity, which could be reinforced if ethnically specific reconciliation efforts that are imbued with a kind of inherently religious dimension are recommended, as is currently implied. Fourth, the TGRC highlights how ethnic identities are constantly being renegotiated. So with regards to sub-Saharan Africa, There's a common idea in the literature that ethnic identities or tribes are social constructions, and that while pre-colonial African identities were fluid, permeable, and overlapping, the more bounded and politically pertinent ethnicities of today are a modern phenomenon and a legacy of a colonial order of delineated control. However, while colonial experience clearly encouraged people to think and act ethnically, they didn't leave a legacy of fixed and unchanging ethnic groups. And this is evident if you follow the TGRC and the ways in which identities can be interpreted and reinterpreted at the local level in ways that kind of deconstruct, if you like, accepted ethnic groups. So one example was a memorandum presented by the Suba in Kisumu. And the Suba are often regarded as part of the larger Luo ethnic group, but representatives stressed that they'd been marginalised by their Luo neighbours and were distinct. And this, the extent to which this is a rereading of normal politics is the way in which people try to reclaim the memory of Tom Mboya, who for most people is not a Suba politician but a prominent leading Luo politician of the late colonial, early post-colonial period, who was assassinated in 1969. And this is true of other submissions, and I think together it shows how a kind of common mantra in Kenya of how the country consists of 42 tribes is pretty meaningless in practice and is up for debate and discussion. More importantly, this ability to renegotiate and redefine ethnic identities clearly renders ethnicity a much more appealing lens through which to understand and approach the political arena, since it allows identities to respond to and reflect local struggles rather than simply be their cause, as is sometimes suggested. So this is to say that, you know, ethnic groups are revealed to struggle not because they exist, but because they've come into existence out of a process of struggle, as E.P. Thompson has argued of the British class system. Finally, discussions at the TGRC reveal how two common explanations of ethnic politics and violence, of a kind of top-down political instrumentalism on the one hand, and competition, kind of local competition over scarce resources on the other, have a real basis in local realities and understandings, but are connected and accompanied by strong collective narratives of belonging and particular suffering that help people, that help encourage people to adopt an ethnic lens to their socio-economic situation and to support ethnic spokesmen and associated policies and programs. So the idea that politicians are ultimately to blame for tribal politics is something that has come across strongly in the TGRC hearings. For example, in the testimonies that are given, but also the people who are summoned to appear at the adversely mentioned people's hearings. And this kind of blame on political elites was evident in hearings on Mount Elgon, where the current MP, Fred Kapondi, and the former MP, John Sarut, both gave testimony and basically said it was the other guy. And that was kind of the depth of the analysis. It was kind of like no one else was in Mount Elgon, and the kind of the only character in their discussions nearly was the other politician. And similarly, the idea that conflicts are ultimately the result of competition over scarce resources has also been central to how some people have presented their understanding of past injustices and abuses. And this is particularly clear in the Rift Valley, for example, where there's kind of a common theme that the key thing in this area is the land issue. I think more interesting is the way in which a close analysis of the TGRC and the TGRC proceedings reveals that these different approaches, which are sometimes cast as alternatives or as opposing theories of violence, you know, classic example being Paul Collier and Anke Hoffler's discussion of greed or grievance, are connected through two narratives, namely a politics of belonging and a politics of a special suffering. And unsurprisingly, this idea of belonging has come out most strongly in cosmopolitan areas, where self-defined locals have come into tension with outsiders. However, while ideas of belonging and autochthony have attracted, or recently attracted, quite a lot of attention in academic scholarship of ethnic conflict in sub-Saharan Africa and beyond, The TGRC also shows how every ethnic group in Kenya believes, often understandably and with real reason, that they used to be relatively well off, but have suffered a particular harm or injustice, or have been denied their just deserts at some point in the past or over time, and that as a consequence, they should enjoy preferential treatment in the present. And some places, this narrative is part of a politics of belonging, while in others, it's more general. So, for example, at hearings in Narok North, a veteran Maasai politician, William Ntumama, who's quite well known for his ethno-nationalist comments, spoke of how the Maasai lost 1 million acres during the colonial period, and we did not get a single one back. Other communities who suffered the same fate got most or all of their land back after independence. In a similar vein, but with less emphasis on an assumed politics of belonging, one witness in Kisumu town, the heartland of Luo Nyanza, spoke of how the education and esteem that the Luo community had once enjoyed was no more, and linked this to the problem of being cast as L or Luo positive. And this was a clear play on the idea of being HIV positive, the fact that, you know, actually HIV rates are highest, they're at their highest in that part of the country. And this comment was met with a lot of kind of supportive head nodding and kind of supportive laughter. And the implication was that from the days of President Kenyatta in the 1960s, the Luo has been cast as supporters of the opposition and as troublesome and prone to rioting, and that they've therefore been marginalised from political and economic power and therefore deserve special attention or rights, etc., in the present. Similarly, this, the Talai elder in Kericho, who's tellingly the author of a book entitled The Once Powerful Talai Clan, recounted how the entire Talai clan had been forcibly removed from Kericho during the colonial period, and concluded that, "I can't think of another ethnic group that suffered the same level of human rights abuses in Kenya or elsewhere. Nowhere in the history of African reaction or European intrusion have a whole community been exiled. We must be compensated and deserve an apology from the British government, as we were moved from a prestigious position of leadership to a marginalised group and were reduced to useless beggars." And after this session, another of the Talai elders who'd accompanied this gentleman came up to me and said that, you know, they're actually as happy to see me as they were the commissioners, as I could take their news back to the British government and HM the Queen. I think the fact that I was sitting in the kind of prominent people's table so that I could listen to the English translation suggested that I might have more influence than I actually do. I did have to point out I didn't know HM the Queen. But I think the point is that the Talai, like many other communities, are using the TGRC as one stage on which to articulate these grievances and to seek justice according to a logic of particular suffering, and that often people are doing this even if they don't actually expect that much from the TGRC process. They might as well try. So I think, you know, what was most striking about public hearings for me was that, you know, despite different injustices and abuses narrated, there was a frequent discourse of how the colonial and or post-colonial state had instigated, promoted or overlooked collective hardships that had led to a deterioration of the people's position relative to ethnic others or relative to what they deserved, and that the Commission must make appropriate recommendations if it was to be successful in revealing truths, promoting justice and fostering reconciliation. So just to summarise the kind of arguments so far, and I think the TGRC as a theatre of power reveals, but may also to a certain extent reinforce, the significance of ethnic difference. It also shows how ethnic identities go alongside and are often reinforced by other identities, such as religion, class and gender. It highlights how ethnic identities are constantly being negotiated and renegotiated and are the result of local struggles. And finally, it reveals how the political salience of ethnic identities in Kenya and their violent potential is a result both of their negotiability, but also of the way in which inequalities and competition over scarce resources can be articulated by elites in a way that resonates with ordinary people through collective narratives of belonging and particular suffering that elites clearly help shape and inform, but which ultimately have a basis in local understandings of historical past and likely futures, and which provide a basis for making arguments or laying claims for special treatment in the present. And in terms of future ethnic relations, I mean, I think the TGRC does offer an opportunity, but it also raises reasons for concern, not necessarily because of the TGRC itself, but because of the kind of larger context. So first of all, the TGRC's approach may reinforce a sense of difference, although I think the limited attention that the Commission enjoys means that any such impact in this way will be fairly minimal. Secondly, there's still a strong belief that state officials and structures and other key institutions are ethnically biased, and there's still high levels of intercommunal suspicion and distrust, especially in areas most affected by post-election violence. And examples include suspicions of and unwillingness to talk to statement takers from other communities, and also confusion of the TGRC with proceedings at the International Criminal Court at The Hague. More concerning, however, is the way in which distrust, together with a view of the state and key institutions as ethnically biased, is further feeding communal narratives of particular suffering and a felt need to keep leaders from certain communities out of power and to get one of your own into power. This came out particularly strongly in discussions around the government's response to internally displaced people and the idea that particular communities had either suffered more or had been helped less. And I think the fact that every group has a narrative of belonging to a particular area and a narrative, some form of suffering or achievement, renders the Commission's job a particularly difficult one. And it's complicated by the way in which socioeconomic and political injustices are seen to be interrelated. So there's a clear idea that's coming out through the hearings that any kind of political injustice has socioeconomic consequences and vice versa. And therefore, when people are making arguments about what's required for justice, there's quite a complicated list. It's not kind of one thing that people are asking for. And I think, you know, this poses a problem, especially since Kenya is currently undergoing a process of reforms. It has a new constitution, and there are a number of reforms that are being implemented or are being discussed. And it's quite difficult for the TGRC, coming at the same time as reforms are already underway, to know what reforms, you know, additional reforms, it should suggest, because it's too early really to know how the reforms that are currently being implemented are going to work out and what their weaknesses will be. I think also the fact that there's these kind of narratives of particular suffering means that any kind of across-the-board assistance or kind of general development policies could be criticised for neglecting how particular communities suffered more than others. And I think what people have often emphasised is their desire for public acceptance of the narratives that they put forward. And this is potentially a problem, as, you know, not all of the narratives will kind of enter the archive, if you like. And the writing and publication of the final report will include a process of scripting, whereby some narratives will be given more space and greater weight than others. However, it seems that, you know, archives are in large part important due to the link between official memory and the ability of the individual and society to forget. But what happens when a group feels that their narratives have not been remembered or have been sidelined in preference to others? Does this mean that they have to work harder to keep the memory alive? I mean, I think in the Kenyan context, this would seem to be the case. And I think an excellent example here is provided by the Kalenjin, who have a strong narrative of lost lands during the colonial period and of inadequate compensation under post-colonial regimes, which they've used to explain violence around election periods. Moreover, many Callendon feel that they've lost out from failing to engage with previous commissions of inquiry and regard the TJRC as an excellent opportunity to set the record straight. And this is clear from the emphasis that people in Carriacho placed on how the TJRC had come to the ground and was listening to them as compared to some other commissions that had stayed in Nairobi or had only gone as far as Nakuru. But what happens if the TJRC listens to such truths and gives them a public hearing but doesn't include them in the archive or link them to recommendations in a way that's locally acceptable? And it's clearly difficult to predict, but it seems that this could be problematic and could be one more thing that kind of feeds into and supports a discourse of being a marginalised ethnic group that is blamed for things, and therefore people have to unite and come together to fight for justice, which are exactly the dynamics that I've argued essential to understanding the involvement of Callendon in election-related violence to date. And I think the kind of the way in which the Kiplagat issue was interpreted is another thing that could kind of feed in to this kind of rhetoric and narrative. So to conclude, the TJRC faces a difficult task, and it's already had more than its fair share of problems, which begs the question of what the whole process is about. I mean, clearly, in contrast to South Africa, the state has not felt the need to ensure that people watch and listen. And therefore, it's not so much about legitimising a new regime or national discourse, at least to the local level. It may have something to do with, say, sending certain messages to donors. And it doesn't seem to be about kind of unearthing the past in order to rebury it more effectively either. Indeed, the limited attention given to the Commission by the government and criticisms of civil society and low levels of public engagement suggest that many people think that the Commission won't achieve much of any substance at all. In response, those who work at the Commission point to the fact that a large number of ordinary people are still engaging with the process, and this is true, and that they're writing statements and submitting memorandum, and they are clearly pleased when the Commission comes to the ground. However, what's quite interesting is the Commission vary on the extent to which they believe their contribution will be through immediate catharsis and the opportunity they give to people to vent feelings that they've had locked up, or the longer-term impact of the recommendations. But I think what's quite interesting from people speaking to people at the hearings is that it seemed quite clear that what most people want is not just an opportunity to vent, although that's, you know, that is something that's appreciated, but they want some kind of reparations, either at an individual or collective level. And I think what's quite interesting is even when people have suffered as an individual, this is often linked to the actions of ethnic others or an ethnically biased state. And it's too early to tell whether these hopes of assistance will be met, but it seems likely that the range of recommendations that the Commission feels it can realistically make, seeing, for example, so far no money has been put aside for a reparation scheme, and the extent to which any recommendations will be implemented, will fall short of such demands. And this could be problematic when local demands are linked to collective narratives of a politics of belonging and a politics of a special suffering, which the TJRC has revealed to be central to the political salience of ethnic identities across the country as a link between political posturing and socio-economic inequalities. So I think it's worth just emphasising at the end that the TJRC has not created ethnic politics, but it has provided, or it serves as a forum, one of the forums in which these discussions and debates are performed, if you like, or played out. And it seems that, and I'm much more optimistic about the Commission, much more supportive of the Commission of the many people, but it seems that due to the low levels of public and political support, it may ultimately be able to do little to provide the justice that so many people seek. Thank you.